This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Korach. A strange and complex gentleman he must have been. But no ordinary gentleman. And no small gentleman. We have to get Korach into correct perspective before we even start. To read it as it reads on the surface, and as it would read in English, and as the non-Jews would read it, it doesn't make any sense. That Korach should have made the kind of mischief that he did. And what did he want it for? What was it all about? He wasn't an ordinary man. Even in their generation, he wasn't an ordinary man. And somebody was saying to me today, just the difficulty sometimes in relating to the greatness of previous generations, certainly down to the prophetic generations, to the generations where there were Nevi'im, where there were prophets. How difficult it is really for us to picture how incredibly great these people were. And in fact it is, because the gap from us to them is just so great that in fact it's impossible to picture. There's no way that you can imagine what Moshe Rabbeinu was. It's just not possible. Michelangelo tries to do it by creating an impression of bigness and power in a physical sense, and he has to do that because he's dealing with stone, and he does it effectively. But still, it's stone. He wasn't that big and powerful man. He was a bit of a meek and mild man. He was old. He was over 80 years old. He had a speech defect. In terms of impressive personality, he wasn't. That wasn't Moshe Rabbeinu. But in terms of magnitude of stature, of greatness of intellect, of greatness of character, of spirit, that it's absolutely impossible, even if we'll use all the imagination we possess, it's absolutely impossible to begin to understand even a little bit about what a Moshe Rabbeinu is about. It's just not possible. It's not even possible to understand what a Yeshua, his Talmud, was like. It's not possible to understand. Come closer, Michael. Come. Let's sit here. It's not possible to understand what a Yeshua was like, what a Shimshon was like, what a Shmuel Hanovi was like, what a Shaul HaMelech was like, what a David HaMelech was like, what a Shlomo HaMelech was like. The gap is just too great. It's not even possible to appreciate and imagine what the Tanoim were like. Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda. Try as you will, you will fail to picture anything close to what these people really were. It's just not possible. The gap is just much too great. It's not even possible to appreciate what the Amoraim were like. Rav Huna, Rabbi Chia, Rabbi Zeira, all these people. An Abaya, a Rova, a Ravina, a Ravashi. It's not possible, using all the imagination we possess and all the knowledge of greatness that we've acquired through studying greatness, because that's after all what Torah is about. Studying greatness, that's what it is. The study and the practice of greatness. That's what Torah is. With all that studying and with all that imagination and with all that understanding and with everything that we've gotten, that we've acquired, it's still not possible to understand and appreciate who the last of the Amoraim, Ravina and Ravashi, was like. It's not possible. And the Rishonim, do you think we can appreciate what the Rambam was? Yes. It's out of our realm of imagination. There are just some things which are beyond us, which you cannot imagine. And the Rambam is one of those. The Rashbo, the Ramban. Not possible to appreciate and to imagine. And even coming down later, try and appreciate some of the Gedolei Achronim, try and appreciate the Rabbi Akiva Eiger. It's not possible. Okay, we learn Gemara and we see a kasha of a Rabbi Akiva Eiger. If you even think to yourself that maybe you could, if you worked hard enough, you would be able to answer it, that in itself shows how little you understand of who Rabbi Akiva Eiger was. There are no answers to Rabbi Akiva Eiger Kasha's questions. When Rabbi Akiva Eiger asks a question, it is a question that has no answer. No answer that any human being living today would be capable of fathoming and understanding. It's just not possible. Lewis, there are chairs here. You can come in. We haven't really started, Lewis. We're still just introductions. We're waiting for you. Avilna Gaon. Can't understand what Avilna Gaon was. It's not feasible. It's just not shaykh to begin to understand the magnitude of his intellect, and equally important, if not more important, his character, the type of person that he was. The only time that one can at least understand, my problem is the following. I'm talking to you and I know you don't believe me. That's what the problem is. I know you're thinking to yourself, okay, he's trying to make a point and he's trying to exaggerate, but no, I can understand. I can imagine what the Vilna Gaon was like. Each one of you is thinking, I can understand. And I can magnify that by a million times, and that's the Rambam. And I can magnify that by a million times, and that's one of the Achrayne HaMeiroim, and so on. And each of you think that really you can, and you can imagine it. You can't. And the only time that you realize that you can't imagine it is when you come into contact with leftovers from the previous generation, of which there are very few, or were very few. And unfortunately, in Torah altogether today, we're producing a generation the bulk of whom have not had contact with the previous generation at all. At least some of the people on the wall over here, some of them that aren't yet on the wall, are leftovers from the last generation, and most of them, I think all of them, are no longer alive. But most of them died, some of them died relatively recently. Post-war, Rabbi Kahneman, the second on the left, and Rabbi Isaac Scher was fairly recent. The Shteytl is still alive. The Shteytl is still alive, Baruch Hashem, the second from the right. The Geira Rebbe on the left here died recently. Rabbi Abramsky died recently. My great uncle, Rabbi Yelopian, on the right there died recently. They were leftovers of the previous generation. It has been possible to get to know, but there were very few of them even 10 years ago. And today, I think there's hardly anybody left. When one did come into contact with them, and one realized the gap between them and us, never mind further back, then one began to realize what's happening here. And when one heard them talk about their Rabbein, and them talk about the fact that unless you saw their Rabbein, you wouldn't understand that gap, then you started to understand now what's going on. I'm talking to a man whose greatness is such that I can hardly relate to it. It's beyond me. And he's telling me about his own Rabbeim, his just one generation earlier, how he couldn't relate to them because they were so great. Then one begins to realize, and one's still nowhere near the old generations. One's still just a couple of decades away. One hasn't gone anywhere yet. When one hears and understands the caliber of people, of ordinary people, never mind the Rabbonim and the Rosh Yeshivas, who used to live in Lithuania before the war, just the shoemakers and the tailors and the businessmen, and the school teachers, when one hears about them and their greatness, and their greatness of character, and their courage of conviction, and their mesilas nefesh, and their integrity, and their loyalty, and their straightness, one begins to understand what it was, what that generation was. And certainly when one understands a little bit about the culture of the Gedolei Yisrael of that generation, one begins to understand we're only talking 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, that's all we're talking about. And we're talking about a generation which is beyond our wildest imaginings. And we haven't even started scratching the surface yet. When one begins to understand that, then one begins to understand a little bit that it's possible that we're unable to understand how great the earlier generations were. But take it from me, as great as you can imagine, I don't think you can get as far as these people with your imagination. That's as far as it's possible for anybody who hasn't seen these people in close touch. Anybody who hasn't seen these people, the greatest you can get to maybe with your imagination is to be able to imagine how great they were. Maybe. But not beyond that. And if you were able to see these people, maybe with your imagination you can get one generation further back to appreciate how great they were. Maybe. That's already a stretch. But no further than that. It's not possible. Technology becomes more and more sophisticated every generation. But greatness of humanity is becoming more and more degenerate among the ordinary people and among the leadership. And we find that not only in Yiddishkeit, it's in every sphere. We don't have the artists that we had in the old days, and there are no Rembrandts today. There are no Van Goghs today, as Meshuggah as he was. There just isn't such a thing. There are no of the real old masters. There are no Shakespeare's today. There are no Beethoven's and Mozart's, and certainly no Bach's today. We don't have them. Just they haven't been for hundreds of years. We haven't had them. And what we're having is just so little and insignificant in terms of what there was, that it's exactly the same thing as is happening in Yiddishkeit, in Torah circles. It's happening everywhere where greatness of spirit is required rather than mere technological progress. We're becoming mentally more skilled in terms of technological brilliance, but we're not becoming greater human beings capable of producing greater works of creation. And this goes back right to the early generations, where Rabbi Zeira said, in trying to give an idea as to what his Rabbeim were like, Rabbi Zeira said to his Talmidim, in trying to explain to them what they were like, he says, you know, if they, the previous generation, were like angels, we're like human beings. And if the previous generation were like human beings, says Rabbi Zeira in Gemara Shabbos, then we're like donkeys. He says, but not donkeys like Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoel. Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoel had a very intelligent donkey. He says, we're not like that kind of donkey. We're just like ordinary kinds of donkeys. In other words, what he's trying to say is, and the Gemara doesn't exaggerate, when the Gemara gives a phrase like that, it's accurately worked out. When the Gemara says that if they were like human beings, we are like donkeys, that's the difference. The difference, the jump, the gap between those two generations was like the gap from a donkey to a human being, or like the gap from a human being to an angel. It wasn't a quantitative gap. It's a qualitative gap. It's a different kind of human being. It's not that these people were like us but better, like us but cleverer. They weren't like us at all. They weren't motivated by the things that motivate us. They weren't driven by the things that drive us. They weren't irritated by the things that irritate us. They didn't think about the things we think. They operated on a completely different basis, on a completely different level. These people. How much more so their generation, their rabbeim, their teachers, and so on and so back. It's a qualitative difference. These are different people. I suppose that's to be expected, that Moshe heard the Torah from God himself. Yeshua heard the Torah only from Moshe. That's a big gap. That's a big jump. Not even in years, in a few days. Yeshua and Moshe are contemporaries, but Yeshua learns from a man as great as Moshe. But go and compare that to learning from God. And then as great as Yeshua is, go and compare the Talmidim of Yeshua to Yeshua himself. They learn from Yeshua. That's fantastic to learn from Yeshua. But go and compare that to learning from Moshe Rabbeinu, the author himself. There's no way you can compare it. And so that's the kind of gap that you have with each generation thereafter. It's not possible to give over to you. I can't give over to you what I got from my Rabbeinu. That's not possible. Because part of what I got from my Rabbeinu was getting it from them. That perhaps was the most important part of all. Hearing it from them, learning it from them, watching it in them. That was the most important part. So it's not possible for me to give that to you. And that when that's lacking, so you can just get the outer shell of it. And you will be able to pass on to those who you teach and speak to. You'll be able to pass on the shell of what you have learned. And so it's just the shell of the shell of the shell ultimately that gets passed on from generation to generation. And we strive as hard as we can to get back to the origins. If a man like, we can't really appreciate how great these people were, and we can't appreciate how great their teachers were, and there's no way we can imagine what the Vilna Gaon was, and the Rishonim, and the Amoraim, and the Tanoim, and the Malochim, the kings, and the Shoftim, the judges of the generations. Go back a little bit further, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. What about this generation? The Talmidim of Moshe Rabbeinu. Can you imagine how great they were? You can't imagine how great they were. It's just, I'm dealing in such infinite concepts that it's absurd even to try and figure out and feel who these people were. I'm not talking about Moshe, and I'm not talking about Yeshua. I'm talking about the ordinary man in the street in that generation, the man who sat at Yeshua's feet and learned, the man who sat at Moshe's feet and learned, the man who every Friday night when he went to shul, he didn't hear a drosha from Reb so and so, he heard a drosha from Moshe Rabbeinu. When he had a shayla, he went. When he had a din Torah, who did he go to for a psak? Not to some rabbi down the road. He went to Moshe Rabbeinu. Go and compare those people who were able to eat out of the hands of Moshe Rabbeinu to anybody else that have subsequently lived. There's no way we can compare their greatness to the greatest that we're able to conceive of. Think of the greatest you know, the Vilna Gaon. Nothing compared to the people who lived, the ordinary people who lived in those days. No comparison. And Korach? Korach wasn't an ordinary person in those days. Korach was one of the leaders. on the top of the top. He was no ordinary man. He was right at the top echelon. You had Moshe, and you had Aaron, and Moshe's children, and Aaron's children, Yehoshua, the Nesiim, and Korach. Korach was then sort of third echelon, from the very top, right at the top. And the Medrash Tanchuma says, Chacham Hayo, even in those generations, at that time, he was considered a Chacham, he was considered a wise man, a very great man. This is no ordinary person we're talking about. Now, when you've got it in that kind of perspective, now try and make sense of the story. If you're talking about ordinary people like you and me, then the story could make a little bit of sense. There's this ambitious Moshe Rabbeinu and this jealous Korach, and they're having a bit of a personal vendetta. But it doesn't work like that. That just doesn't make sense. It can't be. None of these people would do it. Not one of them. It wouldn't enter their mind. It's not feasible to imagine any one of these people on the wall would do what Korach did. Chas v'shalom. And their teachers, and their teachers' teachers, and let's go back and back and back until Korach himself. It's just not feasible at all. And in learning Tanakh, particularly learning Chumash, that's one of the most important things to understand at all times, the historical perspective of the characters with whom you're dealing. They're not you and me. They're very, very different. And they need to be understood in a very different way. So what caused Korach to do these terrible things? So Rashi says at the beginning, Rashi asked the question, what got into Korach's mind to have an argument with Moshe Rabbeinu? Who would pick an argument that you pick Moshe Rabbeinu to have an argument with? It's absurd. Who would do such a thing? What got into Korach's mind to fight with Moshe? Answers Rashi, Niskane al nesiyusoy shel ilitzofon ben uziel sheminohu Moshe nosiel b'nei kahas al pi adibur. He became jealous over the appointment of Elitzofan ben Uziel, who was appointed by Moshe as the head of the family of Kahat on behalf of God. Omar Korach, Korach said, Achi Abba Arbo Hoyu. There were four brothers, there were three brothers, three and my father, that's four of them altogether. That is, Kahat had four sons, of whom Yitzhar was one, that was Korach's father, and Amram was one, who was Moshe's father. So Moshe and Korach were first cousins. It was part of the Mishpacha. He's right in the royal family there. Amram Abachor, the oldest one, was Amram. Not Lushne Bonov Gedula. Both his two sons were appointed to great positions. His one son was Moshe, Echod Melech, one is the king, the Echad Kohen Godol, and Aaron, the second son, is the Kohen Godol. So Amram's sons have all got good jobs. Miroi Lito Lesashnia. The next job which is to be offered out, the next office, the next responsibility to be handed out, surely it goes in order of seniority. Loyani Shani Ben Yitza, Shihusheni La Amram. I am the oldest son of the second son of Kahas. Right? So Kahas had Amram, and Amram's sons are Moshe and Aaron. And Kahas' second son was Yitza. And Yitzhak had Korach. So Korach says, surely I'm next in line in terms of succession. The next honor that there is to be handed out surely comes to me. V'hu monu nasiyis ben achi v'akotin mikulo. And he is appointed for the nasi Elitzofon ben Uziel, the son of Uziel, who is the youngest of the four children of Kehas. He's the most junior member of our family. He's appointed as the head of the family. Hareini chaylek alav, I disagree with him. Umevatel is dvarav, and I cancel, I challenge his words. This is wrong, says Korach. That was the argument, says Rashi. Still doesn't help much. Still, these people wouldn't have done that kind of thing. It doesn't make any sense. Korach's jealous because his younger cousin was given an office of responsibility and he wasn't. Very difficult to understand. And there's something more difficult to understand. Rashi goes on. And he says, Mo'aso, so what did he do? What did this Korach do? Omad v'kines reish nun roshe sanhedrois. He gathered together 250 heads of the Sanhedrin. Do you know how great they were? The Sanhedrin are the biggest Talmidei Chachomim of the age, the biggest rabbinical experts of the age. So now it's not only Korach, but it's Korach with 250 of the leading Rabbonim and Rosh Yeshivas. He's got a very powerful following now. 250. So imagine, let's say in Johannesburg, a man gets up and he has a certain project, and he has behind him all the Rosh Yeshivas and all the main Rabbonim in the town are backing him. That's impressive. They can't all be wrong. And he made them all wear talisim, which are altogether blue, which are made, they all had tcheles. Because the din is in those days that on the tzitzis, one thread on the tzitzis had to be colored blue, special colored tcheles, which you used to get from the blood of a particular sea animal. And one of the strands had to have tcheles. And he came and he gave them talisim, which were completely blue. Both on the Lifnei Moshe, and they came to ask Moshe a shayla. 250 Rosh Hashivas. Just picture the scene, but great Rosh Hashivas. Not just little Rosh Hashivas. And what we call great Rosh Hashivas today, these people, much greater than them. Much, so imagine 250 people like this, but greater. All coming and they're all wearing this blue talisim, and they're asking a shayla from Moshe. Amru loy, they said to him, Talis shekulo shel tcheles chayeves betzitzis or peturah. A talis which is completely blue, does it need tzitzis or not? Omer lehim chayeves, he says, yes, it needs tzitzis. Hitchilu l'sachik alav, they started laughing at him. What kind of a leader of you? You don't even know the din. Efsha talis shel min acher, chut echot shel tcheles. Toitra, zu shekulo tcheles lo tifter es atzmo. So he laughs at them, he says, it doesn't make any sense. If I wear a white talis, one thread of tcheles, and that's all I need. And here I've got a whole garment which is completely blue, and you tell me that I still need tzitzis. It doesn't make any sense. And the Medrash says, there was another ashayla that they asked after this. They said, what is the din if a house is full of Sifrei Torah? Packed full of Sifrei Torah, does it need a mezuzah? And Moshe said, yes, it needs a mezuzah. And they laughed, they said, what's in the mezuzah? In the mezuzah there are a few paragraphs from a Sefer Torah. He has a house full of the complete thing, and you tell me you need to take a couple of paragraphs out and put it on the door. Doesn't make any sense. Any little cheder boy knows that they're wrong. That's not that the Moshe is right, obviously. So even more disturbing than just understanding what went wrong with Korach in the sense of what motivated him, it's important to understand a wise man like this, a Talmid Chochem, supported by 250 of the leading Talmidei Chachomim of the time. What happened to them to ask such stupid questions? What happened to their learning? Their whole learning has gone cockeyed. Their lomdus has gone wild. They're coming out with halakhic conclusions which are weird. And these are great men. What happened to them? That's what we need to understand. Now the interesting thing is that this word miskane, that Korach was jealous of the appointment of Elitzofan ben Uzziel, that word miskane does not appear in the medrash from which this is taken. Rashi takes this from the medrash, it's the medrash Rabbah and the medrash Tanchuma, and in both the medrash Rabbah and the medrash Tanchuma, it doesn't say miskane, it doesn't say that Korach was jealous. The rest is the same as in the medrash. It says that he took issue with Moshe on this particular business, the appointment of Elitzofan, but it doesn't say he was jealous. That's also a little bit difficult to understand why. The medrash is already a little bit easier. So he wasn't jealous. So that this is an issue. This is a principle that they were arguing about. But Rashi says there was jealousy. Where does Rashi get it from that he was jealous? And how a man as great as Korach, how does he become jealous about such a thing? And to understand that, we need to look at another Rashi on Pasuk Zayin. Eventually, Moshe says to the people, you know, the all 250 of you all want to be the boss boy here. It's not possible. Only one can be. It would be very nice if you could all be, but it can't. Only one can be. So if you're prepared to take the risk, he says, come into the Mishkan and you can all do the Ketores offering, which we know only qualified people survive. If you're unqualified, you're going to die. So why don't you all come in if you want to and try it out? And the one who survives, we know, is the real Kohen. So they took him on. Just shows how funny people can be when they think that they are right. Each one knows that 249 people are going to die, and each one believes that he's going to be the one that's going to live. That's how it is. People are funny. And says Rashi again, quoting the Medrash, "V'loy tipshim ayu, weren't they stupid? Shekach hitro behem v'kiblu aleihem." The Karev, that after being warned, the 249 are going to die, and only one is going to survive. They go ahead and they do it. How stupid can people be? Asks Rashi, "V'koyrach shepikeach hayo." Moro lishtuzze. But Koyrat, it's all very well you can say that 250 people were silly. It's difficult to say that the Roshes and Hadrois, that these great Talmidei Chachomim were stupid. That's difficult to say, but okay. Something got into them. But Korach, who was the greatest of them all and one of the greatest men of that generation, and it was such a great generation, what did he do to do something so idiotic? Who takes such a risk? Even if you think you're right. Even if you think you're the genuine one. And probably you're going to survive. Do you go? Do you touch something on that kind of basis? That if you're not the genuine one, you're going to die? Surely not.
Says Rashi, Einoi hitasoi. His eye misled him. Ro'o shalsheles gedula yoytzo mimenu.
He saw a chain of great people coming out of him in the future. That means he was a Novi, he was a prophet. You realize how great Korach was? He was a Novi, one of the prophets of Israel. He could see with prophecy the birth of Shmuel. Shmuel sheshokul keneged Moshe v'Aaron. Shmuel, who was considered as great as Moshe and Aaron put together in many ways. And Korach saw with Nebuah, with prophecy, that Shmuel was going to come, and Shmuel was a descendant of Korach. Omar bishviloy ani nimlat. So very simple. There's no way that God's going to cancel out the birth of Shmuel and kill me. And he was together with his whole family in this, he and his children, and he realized that if he and his family are going to die, no Shmuel is going to be born. And he saw with prophecy that Shmuel was going to be born. His prophecy couldn't be wrong. So he knew that Shmuel was going to be born, which means he knew that he was going to be saved, which means he is right. That's what it means. Doesn't mean that God's going to save him although he's wrong. That's proof that he's right. The fact that a man so great as Shmuel is going to be born, and the fact that therefore he can go into the Mishkan and he can hold this pan of incense and he can bring the Ketores, means that he will not be killed. Everybody else maybe, yes, but not him. That he realizes because Shmuel is going to come from him. As a man who is a Novi, as a prophet. And that's what he sees. Where did he go wrong? Says Rashi, Eino hitos.
Omar, he said, Efsha kola gedula azois asidula amrit mimene vani edo.
Is it possible that all this greatness is going to come from me and I'm going to stand back and watch myself being sidestepped? And Elitzophon is being appointed over myself when I see that the greatness that is to still come from my family.
Lekach nishtatef lovoi loisu chazoka shishono mipi moshi shikulam oivdim vechod nimlat.
Therefore he decided to participate because he heard from Moshe that one person will be saved. If one person will be saved, it must be me, said Korach.
To'o, he was mistaken, v'tolo ba'atzmoi.
And he said it was him, he assumed it was him that would be saved.
Says Rashi, v'loi ro'o yofer. But he didn't see too good.
His sight was mistaken, he didn't see accurately.
Lefi shebonov osu tshuva,
because his sons did tshuva. He didn't realize that he was going to be killed and not his sons. That's what he didn't realize. And that the greatness was going to come from his sons, not from him. He didn't see that.
Moshe hayoroi, but Moshe could see it.
Moshe realized, Moshe also knew that Shmuel was going to come out of Korach. Moshe also knew that this was a great family who was going to have great descendants. But Moshe also knew that the sons were greater than the father. And that those descendants were going to come from the sons, not from the father. That Moshe realized. That's what Rashi says here. Again, it comes from the Medrash. What does it mean? Ve'einoi hitasoi, his eye misled him. There's a perish on the Medrash that says it means his chokhmah misled him, his wisdom misled him. He was, as Churchill I think it was used to say, he was too clever by half. No, he didn't see right. His wisdom misled him. But I think it's possible to say that einoi hitasoi means something else, something much, much deeper in a way.
Eino, his eye misled him in the sense of sarus ayin. The ayin is the way one looks at things.
Ayin is not just one's chokhmah, it's not just what one knows. The ayin, the eye, is how you look at something, which is so critical. You know, you can have people, it's always amazed me, but when you think of it, it's not so amazing. You can have people who are very clever and yet they're terribly stupid. You can have people who are at the top of their professions and they've got no common sense. You can have people who are brilliant, who are absolute geniuses. And they do the most idiotic things. And they say the most idiotic things sometimes. How does it work? What's important is not how brilliant you are. And what's important is not how much you know. All those add. It helps very much to be brilliant as well. And it helps very much to know a lot. But at the bottom of it all, what's critical is how you look. The way you look at something. That's what's really important. The way you see an issue. The way you can analyze something.
how you can take it to pieces. Can you get to the bottom of it? Can you understand what it's really about? Because as clever as you are, if you see a thing incorrectly, all your brilliance, in fact, is just going to distort and distract you even more. If a stupid man sees something incorrectly, he's not going to make terribly big mistakes as a result of it. Now, if you walk and you fall, you hurt yourself a little bit. If you're riding a horse and you fall, you hurt yourself a little bit more. If you're flying an aeroplane and you fall, you kill yourself. That's how it is here too. A stupid man looks at something incorrectly, so he hurts himself a little bit. It's not critical. But when a brilliant man looks at something incorrectly, he can destroy himself and he can destroy the world with it. Hitler was very clever. He was a brilliant man. He saw incorrectly. He looked at the world all in a distorted fashion, and he nearly destroyed it in the process. One can do tremendous harm and danger by seeing a thing incorrectly, irrespective of how clever one is. And that's what Rashi is saying here. Korach was brilliant, there's no question about it. He was a Talmid Chochem of the greatest stature imaginable in the time. He was one of the greatest that there were, in knowledge, in wisdom, in intellect, in everything. And he felt, and probably justifiably in a way, that he had a right to the appointment of the head of the family there. Because he was from that echelon of royalty. He wasn't just an ordinary person by any means. But Eino Hitase. He looked at the problem incorrectly. He analyzed it incorrectly. What makes one look at a thing incorrectly? It can be lack of brains. One can be stupid. That doesn't apply yet. We're talking about somebody clever. So what makes a clever person see something wrong? See something incorrectly, analyze something in an incorrect fashion. Here we come back to the theme that we've been busy with for the last several weeks. It's not intellect that determines that. What determines that is musa. What determines that is one's own character. To be able to look at a thing with humility, to be able to look at a thing with modesty, is a much greater guarantee to seeing it correctly than the brilliant of most brilliant of brilliant people seeing a thing arrogantly. A man who looks at something arrogantly, whether he's looking at a piece of Gemara or a Rashi or a Tosfos, or he's looking at something outside, or he's reading the newspaper or a book, or he's looking at another person and trying to understand him. A man who looks at another situation with arrogance is unlikely to see it correctly. A man who looks with modesty and humility is likely to see it correctly, is more likely to see it correctly. There are many other midos, many other characteristics which can disturb the way one sees. It actually disturbs one's vision. I've told you many times of the experiment that they did in the United States with a class of kids from mixed financial backgrounds, mixed material backgrounds, showing them two pieces of paper. One was a dollar bill and one was a piece of paper, the same color and the same size. But it wasn't a dollar bill. And they asked the children to draw the two pieces of paper on a blank piece of paper which each child was given. And the wealthier the child, the closer was the two papers were drawn the same size. The children from the poor homes drew the dollar bill much bigger than the other paper. The children from relatively poor homes drew the dollar bill a little bit bigger. The children from wealthy homes drew them equal or even a little bit smaller, the dollar bill a little bit smaller than the piece of paper. One begins to see that your value system affects the way you see things. One's vision is affected by who you are, not what you know, not how clever you are. That doesn't affect your vision. Your vision, ultimately, the way you see the world, the way you perceive things, is fixed not by your intellect, or not only by your intellect. That can be trained, your intellect. It's not an intellectual thing to see. To see is a character thing, it's a personality thing. It requires emeskite, it requires truthfulness, it requires modesty, it requires generosity. A man who's not generous, a man who is... What was that word you used the other day, Mrs. Katz, in the latest show? we had the same, but I had the same kind of person who looks with somebody gave exactly the right English word. Yeah, you gave Yiddish word also. But then somebody gave the English word. Somebody who resents what another person's got. Feels, so he's Mekana, yeah, that wasn't the word you used, but it was. He's envious. It bothers him that somebody else has got something. So how's he going to look? How's he going to see? With what kind of clarity is he going to look? The more he will find that the other person has got, the more upset he's going to be. So obviously he's going to look with his eyes half closed. And that's the phrase we use in Hebrew when we talk about sarus ayin, a narrow eye. When you close your eyes and you look with slitty eyes, so that you shouldn't see too much, because the more you see, the more it bothers you, the more it hurts you. So you try not to see how good he is. You try not to see how much he's got, because you know the more you'll see of how much he's got, the more anguish you'll have. So what do you need it for? So it's pure self-protection. You close your eyes a little bit and you look at as little as you can. You look at his weak points. You look at what he hasn't got. You look at where you can catch him out. You don't look at what he has got, because that just makes you upset. So a man who's not generous, a man who gets upset about what the other man has got, how's he going to be able to look accurately? He can't. It's not possible for him to see accurately. When Rashi says, Ein lo hitasoi, that's what he means. It was his tsarus ayin, it was his lack of generosity. It was his kina. It was his jealousy. Sorry? Oh, that's right. Again, so that's right. Sorry? It's not quite resentment, isn't it? Begrudge more. To begrudge what another person has got is closer. It's the begrudging nature of Korach which misled him. That's what it was. But tsarus ayin, ein noi hitasoi. It wasn't his chokhmah. It was his eye. It was the way he saw the world that misled him. He had all the knowledge that you could wish for. He knew the whole Torah inside out. He knew it well. He was brilliant. He was deep. He understood. A giant of intellectual stature. The one thing, he begrudged what other people had that he didn't have. And that misled him. Now how did that mislead him? Says Rashi, he didn't see that his children would do tshuva. That we need to understand. How that tzarus eye and how that narrow slitty eye of Korach led him not to see that his children were going to do tshuva. I need to do a Gemara with you and a Medrash. Before that, by the way, there's a Medrash that I've brought that is just important also in terms of Tzaras Ayin. This is a Medrash in Parshas Samach Aleph in Chayesorah in Breshit. The same as a Gemara in Yevamos Daf Samach Beis, which I've learned with you many times. But there's one word different in the Medrash, which is relevant. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students, 24,000 in all. And they stretched from Akka until Antiparis. The whole area of the country was occupied by Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim. The Kulam Beferik Echod Mesu, and they all died in one period of time, which, as you know, was between Pesach and Shavuos. Lama? Why? Shehoiso Einehim Tzoro Einu Be'ela. Because they had narrow eyes with one another. That's what the Medrash said. Does anybody remember the Lashon in the Gemara? Shaloi nagu bechavad zelze, that they didn't honor one another. And it's the same thing. To honor somebody, if you don't want it to be false, to honor somebody, you've got to see his good points and ignore his bad points. If you look at somebody's bad points and all you see is his bad points and you don't see his good points, you can't honor him. And if you honor him, it's just false. It's not real. It's possible to honor any human being you want to just by noticing his good points. When you notice somebody's good points, you honor them. For those good points, that's all you need to be able to have covered. Remember what Chaim Shmuel Levitz always used to say with Kibbutz Av V'Em, it's not just honor your father, it's study your father to find out all his good points so that you will be able to honor him the way you should. That's what the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av V'Em is. And so it is with every human being in whose covered we are chayav. Every relationship where covered, where honor is expected, it's easy. Even with Moshe Rabbeinu, you can relate to him in such a way that you won't honor him, as Korach did with his friends. You can catch anybody out on something if you don't want to honor them. If you want to honor somebody, you have to search for their good points and see their strengths and relate to that and honor that. And each person has that. Every individual has milas, has strengths, has koiches, has fine points about him that can be honored and that need to be honored, but they need to be perceived. And when you have tsarus ayin, if you're not a generous person, if you lack that aspect of musu that you begrudge what other people have got, are you going to notice other people's strong points? No. In the Mela, you're not going to honor them. So the Medrash says Tzaras Ayin, the Gemara in Yevamos says, Lo Nagu Kovod Zeh B'Zeh, it's the same thing. Where there's no Tovas Ayin, where there's not a good eye, where there's not a big generous eye, there cannot be covered, there cannot be honor. Where there's jealousy, there must be dishonor. Where there's honor, there's no jealousy. So Korach had one fault. The same as last week when we wanted to try and find out what went wrong with the Meraglim, we looked for Midas, because intellectually we couldn't fault them. These were great men. So all we could try and find out is something was wrong, and you remember we found the way they were sent was wrong. the attitude in which they were sent, the way the people sent them was wrong. This disregarding the old people, disregarding the wise people. There was a lack of midas in the sending of the spies, and it became contagious. Since they were representing the people who sent them, they looked at the world with the eyes of those who sent them. That's what we learned last week. This week we're trying to do the same thing. How can a man as great as Korach do something so idiotic? The answer must be in midas. We've got to find something in his character, something in the musa, something in the ethics of the man is not 100% right. And that we've got. We've noticed in the Rashi that Tarus Ayin, he wasn't a generous man. That's all. In every other respect he was great. One downfall he had. He wasn't generous.
Firstly, a Gemara. Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Kuf Yudam Adalef. Vayakon Moshe Vayelech El Dosun Va'aviru. Moshe Rabbeinu has been humiliated by these men. He's been rejected by these men. They've made trouble for him. They've mocked him. They've undermined him in every way they can. Nevertheless, after all that, Moshe gets up and goes to them. Moshe Rabbeinu goes to Dosan Baviru, the two troublemakers. Omer Resh Lakish says, Resh Lakish, Mikan, from this you can learn, She'ein machzikin b'machlekes, that you're not permitted to allow machlekes to take place. The Omer Rav, because Rav said, Kol ha-machzik b'machlokes, anybody who even passively participates in machlokes, in dispute, in argument, even if it's passive, over belav, he's being over a negative transgression of the Torah, Shenemar, as it says, Beloy yihye k'korach u'ch'adosu, and you shall not be like Korach and his congregation. It's a frightening piece of Gemara. Because what does the Gemara say? Okay, so one thing is that there's a lav, there's an issur that you're not allowed to make machlokes. It's an issur in the Torah. And if you do, you're over the issur of being like Korach. And not only are you not allowed to participate in machlokes, but even passively you're not allowed to participate in machlokes. You're not allowed to allow machlokes to take place. But furthermore, did you see what the Gemara said? Where do you learn that from? From Moshe, who went out to talk to Dothan Ba'avira. He's a king after all. And they're guilty of death for what they've done. And the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu and the humility and modesty that after all that he goes to their houses and he's thrown out of their houses, as we read later on. And he knows he's going to be thrown out of their houses. He goes to their houses and says the Gemara, if he wouldn't have, he would have been over the transgression of the being like Korach. How can you compare the two? Moshe Rabbeinu, if he wouldn't have gone out to Dothan and Aviram, would have been like Korach. What's the connection? Korach, who made all the trouble and built it all up and incited the other people into the trouble and was trying to undermine a king, and a king like Moshe Rabbeinu, how are you going to compare him to Moshe, the sufferer of all the trouble making, just because he didn't make enough effort to try and fix it up? He didn't go and visit Dothan and Aviram in their houses. For that, is he over? Is he transgressing the issur of the lo yiyek Korach u'chadosu, that you mustn't be like Korach? So we see a tremendous yesod here, tremendous foundation principle over here, and that is in the parsha of Korach. If Moshe wouldn't have gone to Dothan and Aviram, then Moshe would have been like Korach. But Moshe is right and Korach is wrong. What's the answer? That doesn't matter. In a machlokes, we're not interested in who's right and who's wrong. That's the secondary issue already. The machlokes is wrong. Who's right and who's wrong is not important. We'll come back to that later on when I've done a medrash with you to understand what is important in a machlokes. But who's right and who's wrong is not the critical issue. Because here Moshe was right. Imagine that Moshe wouldn't have gone to Dothan Ba'aviram. He wouldn't have gone to visit them. He was right and they were wrong. He was 100% right and they were 100% wrong. There was nothing right in their argument and there was nothing wrong in Moshe's argument, yet the Torah compares the two together and says you're both equally guilty of machlokes. It's an amazing thing. So what did Moshe achieve with this going to visit Dothan Ba'aviram? What do you do as a troublemaker, two troublemakers? Well, you go into the lion's den. What is he going to achieve out of this? Here we have the Medrash. The Medrash says, this is a medrash in the Yalkut Shimoni. Ulefi sheholach Moshe lefitchei shel Dothan va'aviram, and because Moshe went to the entrance of Dothan va'aviram's house, he didn't go into the house, just to the entrance. Zocha, he was meritorious lahatzil arbot tzadikim midina shel gehenim. He was able to save four people.
He didn't go there to save Dothan and Aviram. He knew there was no point in talking to them. He knew there was no point in trying to solve the machlokes with Dothan and Aviram. That would never work. They're troublemakers. But he saved four other people from death. Who were they? Shalosha b'nei Korach, the three sons of Korach, the Oin ben Peles, and On the son of Peles were saved. Ask the Medrash, how did it happen? That's an amazing story. They're part of their father's family, they're close with their father, they participated with their father. So much that they participated, their father foresaw that since Shmuel was going to come ultimately from them, they wouldn't die, and therefore they must be right. So the sons were with Korach. The Medrash. Shebesho shayu yoshvin etzel Korach avihem. Because there was a moment when they were sitting next to Korach, their father. They were sitting, obviously, deciding tactics, what should be done next, all believing 100% that they are right. And with good reason. Don't forget the Nevuah, the prophecy of Korach. They know they're right, not they think they're right. They know they're right. And Korach is willing to risk his life for this that he believes is right. They were sitting there. Royin es Moshe. They suddenly saw Moshe coming. She's coming to visit them. The Kov Shem is Peneim Bekarkov. They hid their faces in the ground. Didn't know what to do with themselves. Omru, they said. This is now the children talking. And On Ben Pelet. Im Naamud Mipnei Moshe Rabbeinu Noagim Bizoim Ba'avinu. If we'll stand up now, Moshe is walking past. If we'll stand up to honor Moshe, we are disgracing our father. Our father is at loggerheads with Moshe. We can't show loyalty for Moshe at the expense of our father. There's a mitzvah about kibud av v'em, we're to honor our father. And showing honor to Moshe would be an act of disloyalty to our father. So we can't do it. What are we going to do now? We're going to let Moshe walk right past and we're not going to stand up? It already says you have to stand in front of a Talmid Chochem. So even if our father is arguing with him, whatever, but a Talmid Chochem he is, one has to stand. So they paskin for themselves that the correct thing is to stand up for Moshe, even though they are disgracing their father by that act. But at that moment, their whole heart trembled with tshuva, with repentance. And they saw things in their correct perspective, and they did tshuva, and they pulled out of Korach's camp. There are two things here that are terribly important. The one thing is, it explains this Gemara. What is this decision which the sons of Korach had to take? We owe loyalty to our father. It's kibud av v'em. On the other hand, there's a din of mipnei seiva tokum. What are we going to do? To sit on the fence? We can't. Up till now, we could sit on the fence a little bit. As long as Moshe didn't stand in front of us, as long as Moshe and Korach weren't present at the same time with us, we could manage. Moshe comes, we'll stand up. Korach comes, we'll stand up. Nobody would know. It's all right. But with Moshe and Korach together, what do we do now? That's the first time their loyalty is put before them as a moral issue. They've got to make a decision. Here they can't sit on the fence. Sitting down is a slap in the face to Moshe. Standing up is a slap in the face to their father. And they've got to choose. They've got to do one. What is the decision? We've learned already in the Gemara that who's right and who's wrong is not what's important. That's irrespective. Who's right and who's wrong is not an issue. Because if Moshe, although he was right, would not have gone out to Dothan v'Aviram, he would have been as wrong as Korach. Makes no difference. What's important is the din, the halach. These children sat there, these young men sat there, and they said, but at the end of it, we have a din to stand up for Moshe. It's none of our business who's right and who's wrong. We can't paskin who's right and who's wrong. Moshe himself doesn't know who's right and who's wrong. Our father doesn't know who's right and who's wrong. This God will have to decide who's right and who's wrong. We can't decide that. But how we have to behave, we can and must decide. And that we decide our pialach. It's not always our business to know what's right and what's wrong. But it is always our business to behave correctly. And they knew, as the Gemara brings on this parasha as well, if a man makes an argument with his Rav, then he's making an argument with the Ribbono Shel Olam. You can't split the two.
Omer Rabbi Chanina, Kol HaMisraim HaRabbi Kilu Misraim Al HaShchina. If one starts an argument with him, then one starting an argument with the Shchina. Omer Rabbi Avul, Kol HaMaharach HaRabbi Kilu Maharach HaShchina. If one starts questioning one's Rebbe, one's questioning God. You can't interfere with a gap between where you got Torah from and where Torah was given from. That we did about 4 weeks ago. That's that critical link. If you start questioning your Rebbe, then all your Torah is becoming useless. Because that's where you got it from. So if you start questioning your Rebbe now, you're undermining the very source of your Torah. So who are you really questioning? The source of your Torah is the Ribbono Shel Olam ultimately. That's what you're doing. You might decide that your Rebbe is not fit to be your Rebbe, so you leave him, you go somewhere else. But you can't sit and learn Torah from him and question him at the same time. I'm not talking about questioning positively. I'm talking about questioning in the sense of doubting him, not in the sense of understanding. And that the children of Korach knew. We are members of the Kehillah of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Rav in this Kehillah is Moshe Rabbeinu. The king of this community is Moshe Rabbeinu. The din is, if Moshe comes past, we stand. That's the halacha. Who's right and who's wrong in the argument? We don't know and we don't care. That will have to be sorted out some other time. But the halacha is that as long as we're part of this community and we want to remain part of this community, and at this point Moshe Rabbeinu is still the king, we stand when he walks past. That's all there is to it. That's the first yesod we see over here. That who's right and who's wrong is not the issue. The issue is how you behave when a machlokes is taking place. There are halachas as to how to behave. The second thing we see now is what it is that Korach did not foresee. What is it that brought these children to tshuva? In the end of it, it was two things. Moshe Rabbeinu is coming. The fact that Moshe Rabbeinu came. As long as Korach was able to keep his children away from Moshe, he knew that he had them. There's no way they would leave him, their father, for Moshe, somewhere in the distance there. He didn't think that they would be exposed to Moshe. He didn't think they would see Moshe. Because they weren't going to go to Moshe, that was for sure. And they certainly didn't think that Moshe was going to come and visit them. They didn't know Moshe. Korach underestimated the modesty of Moshe Rabbeinu. That Moshe Rabbeinu was prepared to take that walk. Can you imagine what it felt like for him to take that walk across the whole community from his office to walk to Dosan Vaaviram, to go right into the camp and to stand at the entrance and say, Dosan Vaaviram, come, let's put this thing right. That Korach didn't foresee, because to foresee such greatness in another man, you have to have big eyes, you have to be generous. And Korach didn't foresee that. He didn't understand that other people could be so great, that he wasn't able to understand. So he figured that Moshe would never come to his children, and they would never be put in the position in which they were put, which ultimately shook them up. And what was it in the end that shook them up? Again, back to our old theme. All the learning didn't help. All the rationalization didn't help. Their father argued one way, and Moshe argued the other way, and nobody could solve it. And 250 of the finest Talmidei Chachomim of the time paskened like Korach. The learning was able to convince them all that Korach was right. His silly arguments about the mezuzah and the tzitzis, it wasn't so silly. What he's saying basically is, look here, the mezuzah is part of the whole. It's not the whole, it's just a part of the whole. And the part of the whole is, the part is not as important as the whole. Tzitzis. The tchelis, that's just a part of the whole beged. It can't be as important as the whole garment. You, Moshe, are a part of Klal Yisrael. And you can't be as important as the whole of Klal Yisrael. And if the whole of Klal Yisrael feels you're wrong, then we need to make changes. We don't need you there to decide who will be king and who won't. There's an order of things. You were right to be king, and Aaron had to be the Kohen, and next in line is me. That's how one does it, in a democratic sort of a way. Not just in an autocratic way where you decide this one will be king and that one will be king and that one will be king. Who are you? Are you more important than the whole lot of us put together? That's his question. And the Mefoshim go into explaining the longest. They're not stupid questions, this thing with the tzitzis and the mezuzah. It's wrong, but it could be very convincing. And it was convincing to some outstanding Talmidei Chachomim. So all the learning led to a wrong conclusion. All the knowledge led to a wrong conclusion. The persuasion led everybody to the wrong conclusion. What is it that brought these four people back to their senses? The face of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu standing there. and then having to decide, what are we going to do now? Sit down? This man walking past us and I'm going to sit down? It's impossible. If they say, Vatakum, you've got to stand up. For any old man, you've got to stand up. What am I going to do? Let Moshe Rabbeinu walk past and not stand? We cannot do it. It was the confrontation with Moshe's personality, with his character, with his image, that ultimately shook them up. Not just the knowledge. The knowledge misled them. The knowledge led them down the garden path. And that's really the point that I wanted to make to you. The two points. The one is in passing that Moshe could have been as guilty as Korach if it weren't for going over to Dothan v'Aviram. Despite the fact that he was Moshe, despite that everything he did al-pi ha-dibur, he was instructed to do it by God, despite the fact that he was right 100% in everything, and despite the fact that Korach was wrong 100% in everything, nevertheless the Gemara says that the two of them would have been equal. He would have been over the love of Loiti Yeke Korach u'Ka'adosa. Don't be like Korach. Moshe would have been considered like Korach, who's right and who's wrong is not what's important. What's important is what you have to do in the situation. And every machlokes requires its own psak as to how a particular individual has to react to that machlokes. And different individuals have to react in different ways to it. But that's governed by halacha. It's not important who's right and who's wrong. And the second point, which is the important point, is that ultimately, Korach, with all his brilliance and everything, saw the thing incorrectly. And the 250 Roshei Sanhedrois saw the thing incorrectly. And what is it that misled Korach? A bad midah. His conduct, his behavior, one of his attributes, a lack of generosity. He was unable to look at people generously. He was unable to view a situation with generosity, fearlessly, openly. Look at it for what it really is. Don't look at it for what you want to find in it so that you won't be offended. Look and see what there really is there. That's what you want. He couldn't do that. It was a slight flaw in his character, not in his intellect. It was a flaw in his integrity, in his modesty, not in his brilliance. There was nobody to touch Korach in brilliance and in intellectual stature. And his sons followed him and were persuaded by him, the same as the 250 Talmidei Chachomim. The thing that finally got the sons over was simply the fact that they were confronted by having to make a choice between Moshe, not as a concept somewhere in an office, but Moshe standing right in front of them, and the need to either sit or stand. That need to make an action decision in the presence of Moshe's face, that's what finally knocked them into sanity and brought them back to reality. And Korach's mistake was that he didn't realize his own children would do tshuva. And he couldn't see that his own children would do tshuva because he didn't realize the greatness of Moshe. He knew that if his children were confronted by Moshe, Moshe would persuade them that he was right. He knew that his children would not be able to withstand the pressure of the greatness of Moshe. But where are they going to see Moshe, he thought to himself. We're all becoming enlarged in our little camp here. We've been isolated by everybody else. And he didn't foresee that Moshe Rabbeinu was going to take that walk across and come and talk to Dothan v'Aviram. And that walk, although it didn't save Dothan v'Aviram and it wasn't intended to, and it didn't save Korach and it wasn't intended to, and it didn't save the 250 men, it did save those three young men and Oyn Ben Peles. And from them came people, many people, among them people as great as Shmuel Hanovi, who ultimately had an incredible influence on the future of Jewish history and the whole flow of Jewish history. All that came from the little walk that Moshe took from his own office to the tent of Dothan v'Aviram to try, in order not to be over the issue of being like Korach and his Eidah. And here we see how it was the weak midah in Korach which caused him to see incorrectly. It was the strong midah in Moshe which caused him to act correctly. Why was Korach killed and Moshe saved? Not just because Moshe was right and Korach was wrong. Because Korach had a flaw in his character and Moshe didn't. Because Moshe was a tzaddik and Korach wasn't. That's ultimately what was important. Because if they were both tzaddikim, with their brilliance or without their brilliance, if they were both tzaddikim, they could have worked it out. But where you had one of them who was not a tzaddik, one of them who didn't have that openness and that integrity to be able to see things as they really were, there was no hope of sorting it out. And it was that that finally was the psak din, was the sentence that was brought about on Korach and on his Eidah.